Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. In this critical election year, you count on Democracy Now! To stay focused on the stories that matter most. And we count on you to support our independent journalism. If everyone who tunes into Democracy Now! Signed up for a monthly donation of, say, just $6, we could cover our operating costs for the entire year. Really, that's all it would take. Please do your part today by visiting us at democracynow.org. Stay safe. Wear a mask, save lives, and thank you so much. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We have clear scientific evidence they work, and they are our best defense. I might even go so far as to say that this face mask is more guaranteed to protect me against COVID than when I take a COVID vaccine.
I think he made a mistake when he said that. It's just incorrect information.
As the U.S. death toll from COVID-19 nears 200,000, President Trump spars with the head of the Centers for Disease Control over the importance of wearing masks to stop the spread of the virus. We'll speak to Dr. Monica Gandhi, a professor at the University of California, San Francisco, then to David Goodrich, a former climate scientist with NOAA. That's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. His new book, A Voyage Across an Ancient Ocean, A Bicycle Journey Through the Northern Dominion of Oil. Then President Trump calls for the teaching of, quote, patriotic education, alleging there's left-wing indoctrination in the nation's schools.
Our children are instructed from propaganda tracts like those of Howard Zinn that try to make students ashamed of their own history.
We'll hear from the late historian Howard Zinn in his own words.
We tell kids that Columbus, whom they have been told was a great hero, Columbus mutilated Indians and kidnapped them and killed them in pursuit of gold. Should we tell people that Theodore Roosevelt, who is held up as one of our great presidents, was really a warmonger who loved military exploits and who congratulated an American general who committed a massacre in the Philippines? Should we tell young people that? And I think the answer is we should be honest with young people. We should not deceive them.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The White House scuttled a plan to distribute 650 million cloth face masks to every residence in the United States during the early weeks of the coronavirus pandemic. That's according to The Washington Post, which reports Vice President Pence and other officials rejected the proposal because, quote, receiving masks might create concern or panic. A draft press release about the plan from the U.S. Postal Service reads, the first shipments are expected to reach U.S. households as early as April XX, with the date left incomplete. One study by the Center for Economic Policy Research found widespread mask use across the United States would have saved 40,000 lives in the months of April and May alone. The official U.S. death toll from COVID-19 is rapidly approaching 200,000, with more than 6.6 million confirmed coronavirus cases. On Thursday, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio delayed the start of in-person classes for K through 12 students until at least the end of September, amidst a major staffing shortage in schools and teacher protests about coronavirus safety measures. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports a recommendation by the CDC to radically scale back coronavirus testing was not written by scientists and was published over their strenuous objections. Last month, the CDC's website quietly changed its guidance to recommend people without symptoms should not be tested, even if they've been in close contact with an infected person. The new CDC guidelines contain basic scientific errors, suggesting they were drafted by a political operative rather than an expert in infectious diseases. One unnamed federal official told the New York Times, quote, "That was a doc that came from the top down from Health and Human Services and the White House task force," they said. President Trump's personal lawyer, Mark Kasowitz, has threatened to sue scores of Stanford professors and researchers after they published an open letter denouncing the qualifications of Scott Atlas, a colleague at Stanford who's now advising Trump on the pandemic. Atlas is a neuroradiologist with no expertise in infectious diseases. The Washington Post recently reported Atlas is pushing Trump to promote a controversial herd immunity strategy, which could result in the deaths of millions more Americans. In an open letter, the Stanford doctors, epidemiologists, infectious disease docs, and researchers wrote of Dr. Atlas, quote, "The guidance he is giving to the White House does not reflect sound epidemiological reasoning, nor is it consistent with the current body of scientific knowledge about COVID-19. Attorney Mark Kasowitz, who's now representing Atlas, has threatened to sue signatories of the open letter and has demanded a retraction by today, saying the letter maliciously defames his client. Stanford professor Michael Fishbach responded to the threat by writing on Twitter, quote, "I stand by everything we said, more facts, more science, less Kasowitz." Full disclosure, my brother, Dr. Steve Goodman, is a dean at the Stanford School of Medicine, one of the signatories to that letter. Globally, confirmed cases of coronavirus have topped 30 million. India recorded another 96,000 new cases over the last 24 hours, putting the nation of 1.3 billion on track to surpass the United States within weeks as the country with the highest number of infections. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization is warning of a new wave of coronavirus cases across Europe, with more than 300,000 new infections in the last week alone. The WHO says the surge reflects not only more comprehensive testing, but alarming rates of community spread across the continent. Back in the United States, the Department of Labor is reporting another 860,000 workers filed for new unemployment benefits last week. Since the pandemic began, around 60 million jobless claims have been filed, a new record. Meanwhile, the total net worth of the nation's billionaires has soared by nearly $850 billion since mid-March, a 29% increase. That's according to a new study by the Institute for Policy Studies. This comes as a new poll conducted by NPR and researchers at Harvard finds economic fallout from the pandemic has hit communities of color the hardest. The study found 72% of Latinx households, 60% of Black households, 55% of Native American households have reported serious financial problems this year, with trouble paying for food, housing, and debt. A federal judge in Washington state's temporarily blocked the U.S. Postal Service from new operational changes that have slowed down mail delivery ahead of the election. Judge Stanley Bastian accused President Trump and Postmaster General Louis DeJoy of being, quote, "involved in a politically motivated attack on the efficiency of the Postal Service." He also said the changes created a, quote, "substantial possibility many voters will be disenfranchised," unquote. On Thursday, Trump continued to cast doubt on mail-in voting. In a tweet, he wrote, "The November 3rd election result may never be accurately determined, which is what some want," unquote. Twitter flagged Trump's tweet and provided information about how voting by mail is safe and legal. A former top aide on the White House Coronavirus Task Force has announced she's voting for Joe Biden, claiming President Trump has shown a, quote, "flat-out disregard for human life," unquote. Olivia Troy served as Vice President Mike Pence's lead staffer on the task force from February until July. Troy is featured in a new ad by Republican voters against Trump.
Middle of February, we knew it wasn't a matter of if COVID would become a big pandemic here in the United States. It was a matter of when. But the president didn't want to hear that because his biggest concern was that we were in election year and how is this going to affect what he considered to be his record of success. It was shocking to see the president saying that the virus was a hoax, saying that everything's okay when we know that it's not. The truth is, he doesn't actually care about anyone else but himself.
In Bolivia, self-proclaimed interim president Jeanine Añez has suspended her campaign for president in an attempt to unify conservative votes against the MAS party, formerly led by ousted longtime president Evo Morales. This comes less than a year after the extremist right-wing leader rose to power following a military coup against Morales. Añez's reign has been marked by skyrocketing military and police repression and violence against indigenous communities and supporters of Morales. The presidential election is scheduled for October 18th. In Russia, aides to opposition leader Alexei Navalny said Thursday German scientists discovered traces of the banned nerve agent Novichok on a water bottle in the Siberian hotel room where Navalny stayed before falling ill aboard a flight to Moscow last month. Navalny is a vocal critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin. He survived the apparent poisoning and was airlifted to a hospital in Germany where he's recovering after coming out of an induced coma. A warning to our audience. The following headline contains graphic descriptions of sexual assault. Another woman has stepped forward to accuse Donald Trump of unwanted sexual contact. Amy Doris says Trump cornered her and assaulted her at the U.S. Open tennis tournament in 1997. She spoke with The Guardian in an interview published Thursday.
He just grabbed me and he just shoved his tongue down my throat and I was pushing him off. And then that's when his grip became tighter and, you know, his hands were kind of like very gropey and all over, you know, my butt, my breast, my back, like everything. But he was just like, his grip was hard. You know, you couldn't pull away. I was pushing his tongue out of my mouth with my teeth. It was pretty traumatic.
Amy Doris joins at least 25 other women who've accused Trump of some form of sexual misconduct, with over a dozen claiming sexual assault. In 2005, Trump was caught on a hot mic recorded by the show Access Hollywood, boasting about sexually assaulting women.
Use some Tic Tacs just in case they start kissing her. You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Florida, a lawsuit involving 15 prisoners, alleges rampant sexual violence from guards at Federal Correctional Complex Coleman, one of the largest federal prisons in the country. The women say the abuse lasted for years, dating back to 2012, and that they were threatened by guards with being transferred to prisons with worse conditions if they spoke out or didn't comply. At least six of the accused officers have admitted in government court filings to engaging in sexual misconduct at the Florida prison. None of the guards have been prosecuted. Instead, they were allowed to resign or retire, and some still receive benefits. One of the accused guards worked at the prison until 2019. A new report by immigration rights advocates highlights an alarming pattern of human rights violations against pregnant and postpartum asylum seekers in the custody of Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Customs and Border Protection during the pandemic. Some of the accounts include a Guatemalan asylum seeker who was forced to give birth next to a trash can while still wearing pants, and a pregnant Honduran asylum seeker who was expelled to Mexico while she was having contractions. This follows shocking reports that a doctor at an ICE jail in Georgia has been performing hysterectomy on immigrant women without their consent. The House of Representatives has passed the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, requiring U.S. employers to make reasonable accommodations to people who are pregnant. Over 100 Republicans joined majority Democrats in Thursday's roll call. Labor rights advocates are demanding Republicans take up the bill in the Senate, where Majority Leader Mitch McConnell remains focused on pushing through Trump's judicial nominees, eight of whom have been confirmed this week to lifetime appointments on the federal bench. A warning to our viewers, the following story contains disturbing images of police violence. In Utah, a Salt Lake City police officer has been charged with felony aggravated assault after body camera footage showed him ordering a police dog to attack a black man who was on his knees with his hands in the air. Prosecutors say 36-year-old Jeffrey Ryans was not resisting arrest and posed no threat to officers before the April assault, which left Ryans with severe nerve and tendon damage to his leg. If convicted, Officer Nicholas Pierce faces up to 15 years in prison. President Trump lashed out Thursday at educators who teach about the United States history of slavery and racism, announcing a so-called patriotic education plan to combat what Trump called toxic propaganda in schools. Trump was speaking at the National Archives Museum in Washington.
The left-wing rioting and mayhem are the direct result of decades of left-wing indoctrination in our schools. It's gone on far too long. Our children are instructed from propaganda tracks like those of Howard Zinn that try to make students ashamed of their own history.
President Trump was referencing Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. In response, the Zinn Education Project tweeted, "So what explains the rebellions in 1676, 1680, 1786, 1831, 1859, and more by Native Americans, enslaved Africans, coal mines, and more? Howard Zinn wasn't alive then," they tweeted. Trump also called the teaching of critical race theory a form of child abuse and lashed out at the 1619 Project, the Pulitzer Prize-winning series which reexamines the legacy of slavery. On Twitter, 1619 creator Nicole Hannah Jones pointed out, quote, "The White House Conference on American History has not a single black historian on it. Strange," she wrote. We'll hear the late historian Howard Zinn in his own words later in the program. And two more federal executions are scheduled for next week at the U.S. Penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. One of the prisoners, Christopher Villalva, is being put to death for a crime he committed when he was 19 years old. This is Villalva in his own words in a rare video from death row.
"People are not being informed about the racial disparity on federal death row. Black people are only 13% of this country's population, yet we are almost half the population of federal death row. Now I'm making my plea to the American public to rethink the federal death penalty. The Democratic Party claims they want to abolish the death penalty, yet no politicians have said anything about federal death row. Public figures, lawyers, and abolitionists are nowhere to be found in the national media on the subject of capital punishment, yet men are being paraded to the federal death house right now."
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. When we come back, as the U.S. death toll from COVID-19 nears 200,000, President Trump is sparring with the head of the CDC over the importance of wearing masks to stop the spread of the virus. We'll speak to infectious disease specialist Dr. Monica Gandhi. Her message, masks, masks, masks. Stay with us.
La tierra tiene fiebre, necesita medicina y un poquito de amor que le cure la penita que tiene. La tierra tiene fiebre, tiembla, llora, se duele del dolor más doloroso. Y es que piensa que ya no la quiere. Tiene fiebre, tiembla, llora, se duele del dolor más doloroso. Y es que piensa que ya no la quieren. Y es que no hay respeto por el aire limpio. Y es que no hay respeto por los pajarillos. Y es que no hay respeto por la tierra que pisamos. Y es que no hay respeto ni por los hermanos. Y es que no hay respeto por los que están sin tierra. Y es que no hay respeto ni cerramos la frontera. Y es que no hay respeto por los niños chiquilinos. Y es que no hay respeto por las madres que buscan a sus hijos.
Scatta la Tierra by Bebe. This is Democracy Now!, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the official U.S. death toll from COVID-19 approaches 200,000, with more than 6.6 million reported cases, The Washington Post has revealed the White House scuttled a plan to distribute 650 million cloth face masks to every resident in the United States during the early weeks of the coronavirus pandemic. Vice President Pence and other officials rejected the proposal because, quote, receiving masks might create concern or panic. A draft press release about the plan from the U.S. Postal Service reads, The first shipments are expected to reach U.S. households as early as April XX, with the date left incomplete. One study by the Center for Economic Policy Research found widespread mask use across the United States would have saved 40,000 lives in the months of April and May alone. This comes as the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention warned Wednesday U.S. residents should not expect to receive a vaccine for the coronavirus until at least mid-2021, contradicting President Trump's claim at least 100 million doses could be distributed by the end of 2020. Dr. Robert Redfield was speaking at a Senate hearing on the federal government's response to the pandemic.
Face masks, these face masks are the most important, powerful public health tool we have. And I will continue to appeal for all Americans, all individuals in our country, to embrace these face coverings. I've said it, if we did it for 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks, we'd bring this pandemic under control. These actually, we have clear scientific evidence, they work, and they are our best defense. I might even go so far as to say that this face mask is more guaranteed to protect me against COVID than when I take a COVID vaccine, because the immunogenicity may be 70%. And if I don't get an immune response, the vaccine's not going to protect me. This face mask will.
President Trump lashed out at Dr. Redfield's testimony, telling reporters in the White House press briefing room the top U.S. public health official misspoke.
I think he made a mistake when he said that. It's just incorrect information. And I called him, and he didn't tell me that, and I think he got the message maybe confused.
Trump also contradicted the CDC director over masks, saying a vaccine would be much more effective than facial coverings at stopping the spread of the coronavirus. His comment came after Dr. Redfield estimated a potential coronavirus vaccine might only be 70% effective at generating an immune response, making widespread mask use critical to ending the pandemic. During a town hall event Tuesday on ABC, hosted by George Stephanopoulos, Trump again downplayed the use of masks.
There are a lot of people think the masks are not good. And there are a lot of people that, as an example,
who are those people?
Well, I'll tell you who those people are. Waiters, they come over and they serve you and they have a mask. And I saw it the other day where they were serving me and they're playing with a mask. I'm not blaming them. I'm just saying what happens. They're playing with a mask. So the mask is over and they're touching it and then they're touching the plate. That can't be good.
Well, for more, we're joined by Dr. Monica Gandhi, an expert in infectious diseases, professor of medicine and associate division chief of the Division of HIV, Infectious Diseases and Global Medicine at UCSF, San Francisco General Hospital. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dr. Gandhi. It's great to have you with us. If you can respond to what President Trump is saying and how important you think masks are.
Yes, I think this is great that you're talking about this on this program because masks are a pillar of pandemic control. They're incredibly important. And there is no country in the world right now who has been fighting masks like this, especially at the presidential level. And if we could have started mask wearing, consistent mask wearing at the beginning, we would have averted deaths and cases. And, you know, one thing I do have to say, because I remember this day very well, the day that the CDC recommended population level mask wearing, which was April 3rd. And the way it was told to us as the American public was by the president of the United States. And he came out at a press conference and said, held it up and said, I think these are optional. I think it's voluntary and I'm not going to wear it. And that way of messaging to the American public, including what you just said over the last couple of months, has been very detrimental to our attempt to get universal mask wearing.
Why is it so critical? What Trump has failed to do, and in so doing, puts out a very strong message. He refuses consistently to wear a mask. Only a few times in all of the months of the pandemic, and the last time was in a hospital. So, you know, people do wear masks in hospitals. President Trump refuses to wear a mask. When questioned about whether he was endangering the thousands of people who come to see him at a rally who are largely maskless, he says, look at me, I'm socially distancing. saying I'm fine up here, which is probably true, but they are not. They are not social distancing. They are not wearing masks. Explain, though it may be intuitively obvious to people, why masks make a difference and when you came to this conclusion.
You know, masks make a huge difference. I don't think I could stress how important I think this is as a pillar of pandemic control. So what, there are two reasons that masks work so very well. One is that, you know, when this started spreading the coronavirus so quickly at January, February, March, people were like, what could be happening? People started talking about surfaces, fomites, you know, there was such confusion. And then really what happened is that it turns out, and we haven't seen this for a long time in infectious diseases, that even though you feel well, you can shed the virus at high rates from your mouth and nose, even when you feel fine. And by definition, that asymptomatic spread means that if you cover your mouth and nose, which is where it's coming out, that you can protect others. That's one point about masking, that you protect others. I think there was a problem at the beginning of the pandemic that we just messaged that these can protect others. We are not in a stage in our country that civic duty and is working out really well for us. And to be honest, we should have probably messaged that it protects others and protects yourself. And where do we get the idea that it protects yourself? From decades of literature with other respiratory viruses, that putting on a mask protects you. I mean, it actually is totally, completely common sense, actually. But the idea that it protects you is that you block the areas in which you're most likely to imbibe the virus, your nostrils and your mouth. And so, we've actually started messaging in California and San Francisco, where I live. We've changed our messaging to say protect you and protect others. So there's two huge imports of masks, which is it protects others, it protects you. And if we could just wear this, and I really commend Dr. Redfield for saying it so forcefully, the clip that you just played on your program 2 days ago to the Senate, if we could just do this consistently, we can get through this pandemic. There are other strategies, of course, but this is a pillar of pandemic control.
I mean, this is quite amazing what Dr. Redfield said. He said this could be more effective, not just a supplement, more effective than a vaccine. Talk about the effectiveness of masks and why it matters, the whole issue of asymptomatic versus people who die.
Yes, it means so much to mask. Now, there's another theory that's being propounded that it also helps decrease the severity of disease, because if you mask up, you get less viral particles in. And if you get less viral particles in, say that you were unlucky to get infected, you get less viral particles in. There's evidence from animal models and outbreak investigations and even country level data that you're less likely to get sick. Of course, it's important to drive up the proportion of those who have asymptomatic infection. This is a deadly disease for some. And then for others, they're completely well. It's actually really confusing and protean in its manifestations. Dr. Fauci has said this many times. How do you get people being completely well and some people being so ill? And so anything that we can do to drive up the proportion of people who feel well, that's exactly what we should be doing. And the important part about that is they can also spread it if they feel well. So masking is so incredibly important for the response. There has never been a country where mask guidelines are announced by someone with reluctance, by someone who doesn't model mask wearing. I can't really stress the importance of modeling by public health leaders, by presidents, by mayors, by governors, to convince the populace that this is important. Raising questions on masks 6 months into the pandemic, when we have been the epicenter of the pandemic since March 26, we have not moved from that dubious position. Literally, the pandemic actually was declared by the WHO on March 11th, because before that it was called a global health emergency. March 11th, pandemic. March 26th, the United States becomes the epicenter. And we haven't budged from that position. We're clearly doing, you know, many things wrong. But this mask wearing, if we could have just modeled it from the beginning, I've seen Trump and Pence in a mask, I think twice or thrice. It is so important. I really don't know how to stress how important it is to model that for people in the country.
So So you mentioned other countries. Can you talk about what has been done in other countries and the proof that masks make a difference?
Yes. I mean, actually, it's so interesting because no other country, hands down, has fought mask wearing like we have in the United States. And so I give you two good examples because I really like these examples. Taiwan, March 6th, very early in the pandemic, they have a country near them in which the pandemic is still, raging, which is China. They literally pull out all the stops and make factories and industry convert to mask wearing. Because they knew about mask wearing since SARS, which was the pandemic in 2003. They mass produce masks, and the populace wears them without, debates like this, because it's such an important pillar of control. And they have had a handful of deaths in a country of 23 million people. They hand out masks. They provide masks. They model mask wearing. They message mask wearing. They have billboards with mask wearing. It just wasn't an issue. Same with actually many Asian countries, Vietnam, Thailand, Japan, Singapore, South Korea. From SARS, they knew how to mask. And then I like the talking about the Czech Republic, because they weren't affected by SARS in 2003, but they just figured it out, put out a mandate for mask wearing on March 23rd, also quite early in the pandemic. And they got through their pandemic so quickly. Everyone wore cloth face coverings. And by May 11th, they're like, okay, we're done. You can start taking off your face coverings. They had such low death rates and such a good response. No one has fought it, though, like the United States. No one. So I could name many, many other countries where it's not an issue. Mm.
So your family's from India. Can you talk about what's happened in India, both the catastrophic numbers of cases and how that compares to the death toll, for example, in Mumbai?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question about India. India is, it is catastrophic in terms of number of cases because it is a very dense population and it is a transmissible virus. It is very transmissible. The one cheap, easy thing we have available to us is mask wearing. And when we think about Mumbai, and of course, Mumbai has the largest slums in the world, there is an ability not to socially distance, unfortunately, not to test and treat our way out of the pandemic. There is an ability to wear masks. And there is a hypothesis that the relatively lower death rate compared to other places is that simple modality of taking a piece of cloth, which is very available to us in India, but it means part of the national costume, but taking the cloth and covering the face and nose. I think that places that have had lower death rates, there's lots of hypotheses because we thought it would be higher. And one is that there's possibly cross-reactivity from other coronaviruses that people have been exposed to. And the other is this simple act of covering the nose and mouth.
Do you recommend certain kinds of masks?
Yes. I mean, this is a great question about what kind of masks. The way that I think about it is that N95 masks are very tight-fitting. Those are the ones that we wear in the hospital. They are most effective at blocking out viral particles, but they're very uncomfortable. I wore one the other day, and for like 2 hours, I was like really uncomfortable. They are very uncomfortable, and they do not lend themselves to wearing all day. We actually have to change our strategy where we start thinking it is a piece of our clothing. And beyond that, we really do ask for N95 masks to be preserved for personal protective equipment for healthcare workers. So there's two options, really, that at least, again, from modeling from other respiratory viruses. We can never take people, put masks on them and spray this virus into their face. That would be totally unethical. It's a deadly virus. So from other modelings, from animal studies, it really is two options, I think. One is a surgical mask, which is pretty easy to get. And then the second is a cloth face covering, and I'd recommend cotton with two ply, so not one, but two ply that you can pull apart. Make it fit over your nose and mouth, so definitely have to bring it up over the nose, over the ears, and pretty snug fitting if you can get it, and make it something that becomes part of your. I actually just bought like really pretty masks yesterday, and I was very excited that I now have masks that I'm really like kind of into. It's increasing my compliance. So to be honest, like, we had to make it second skin for maybe a year. I mean, when Dr. Redfield said what he said about vaccines, when we think about preventative modalities for any infectious diseases, we don't know when we're going to get a vaccine. We have to do we have to get to vaccines safely. We have to make them effective. They're not going to be 100% effective. Some vaccine trials have 50% as their vaccine efficacy standpoint. 70% is what Dr. Redfield said, that we may have some that are 70%. You may need two doses. It may take a while to get to immunogenicity. You need some time, and we're going to be wearing a mask that entire time. So make it comfortable, make it cotton or cloth.
Some researchers suggest that people who come into contact with infected people while wearing masks may receive a lower inoculum or dose of the virus, which could make them less likely to develop a severe case of COVID-19.
Yes. That is really based on, it's a theory, but I think it's gaining a lot of observational evidence behind it, that the lower, that because it mass filters out the majority of viral particles, you get less in if you do end up getting infected. And getting less in may lead to a less severe disease. So we get that idea from animal models. Animals who get less virus in, they get less sick. Get an idea from hamsters. Even when you give them less of the COVID virus, they get less sick. And then as we've been watching outbreaks around the world, settings where you're wearing a mask seem to drive down the severity of infection and drive up the rate of asymptomatic disease. More study is needed.
And what about how often you wear the same mask?
Yes, I mean, they shouldn't get wet or soiled. And really, I would wash them at least every other day.
That's if they're not paper.
Yeah, yes, exactly. So paper, you can't wash them. So take your like 5 or 6, you know, cloth masks and wash them every day. Keep them clean and make it part of your day, like make it part of your costume.
Finally, I wanted to ask you, this was that town hall meeting held by ABC, President Trump repeating his claim that the coronavirus would just go away.
We're going to be okay, and it is going away, and it's probably going to go away now a lot faster because of the vaccine. It would go away without the vaccine, George, but it's going to go away a lot faster.
Away without the vaccine?
Sure, over a period of time. Sure, with time. It goes
and many
away.
Deaths.
And you'll develop herd, like a herd mentality. It's going to be herd developed.
Herd mentality, he said. That was President Trump speaking with George Stephanopoulos, appearing to reference herd immunity. And so I wanted to go then to what's happening in your neck of the woods nearby at Stanford. President Trump's personal lawyer, Mark Kasowitz, has threatened to sue scores of Stanford professors, epidemiologists, infectious disease docs, researchers, after they published an open letter denouncing the qualifications of Dr. Scott Atlas, a colleague at Stanford who's now advising Trump on the pandemic. Atlas is a neuroradiologist with no expertise in infectious diseases. He has pushed on Fox News for the controversial herd immunity strategy, which could result in deaths of millions of more Americans. In an open letter to the Stanford docs, the doctors wrote of Dr. Atlas, quote, "The guidance he is giving to the White House does not reflect sound epidemiological reasoning, nor is it consistent with the current body of scientific knowledge about COVID-19, unquote. Attorney Mark Kasowitz, who's now representing Atlas, has threatened to sue the signatories of the open letter, has demanded a retraction by today, saying the letter maliciously defames his client. Stanford professor Michael Fischbach responded to the threat by writing on Twitter, "I stand by everything we said, more facts, more science, less Kasowitz," unquote. And full disclosure, my brother, Dr. Steve Goodman, is a dean at the Stanford School of Medicine, one of the signatories of the letter. But Dr. Gandhi, could you respond to this? No masks and herd immunity.
Yes. So I don't think those two things go together, no masks and herd immunity. So what is herd immunity? It's a true concept. It's a very valid concept. The concept is that when more of the population becomes immune, to the coronavirus or to any infection, that it's the virus is bopping around. It can't find anyone to infect, and it will start slowing its spread. However, there are two ways to get to herd immunity. One is letting natural infection rage. That is not something that we would do with an infection that is deadly to so many people. And the other is a vaccine that will make us immune. And mask wearing, the reasons it's so important is even if you get infected, if you get less of a of symptoms, then that would be another way that it's possible that with mask wearing, you have asymptomatic disease and you can get to herd immunity. But letting mask, no masks, and herd immunity put together is going to result in many more deaths.
In it's just possibly millions of deaths?
Possibly millions of deaths. It is not sound advice. I don't understand being against masks and then being for immunity. I think you have to be for both.
So, and then you have President Trump's personal lawyer threatening to sue scientists who are raising this concern. How does this interfere with the scientific process?
You know, at the moment, it is actually at the beginning of the pandemic, I was excited that I'm an infectious disease doctor. I was like, wow, this is important. Like, I'm doing something that's helpful. To be honest, this has been so politicized and so strange to be an infectious disease doctor in the middle of a pandemic in Trump's America that it is actually what used to be on Twitter. And 3 days ago, I got off because I was getting threats about my propounding mask wearing. And I couldn't understand the threats. By the way, masks don't reduce oxygenation. Oxygen is really tiny. It can get through masks. So it is really difficult to be right now just like speaking clearly about a pandemic and having attacks. And so these scientists are right that you have to just propound what's right, what's tried and true, public health principles, what we know about the infection. And that's how you have to put forth knowledge. And the attacks and the conspiracy theories have been amazing. I'm not seeing anything like this.
Dr. Monica Gandhi, we want to thank you so much for being with us, a professor of medicine and associate division chief of the Division of HIV Infectious Diseases and Global Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. That's UCSF San Francisco General Hospital. Next up, as Hurricane Sally batters the Gulf Coast and climate-fueled wildfires continue to ravage the West, we'll speak with David Goodrich, former climate scientist with NOAA. That's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boys of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boys of mine?
I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free. That's what the teacher said to me. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school.
Good boys. What did you learn in school today, dear little boys of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boys of mine?
I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice
never ends. What did you learn in school today, performed by the Chad Mitchell Trio? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As Hurricane Sally batters the Gulf Coast and climate-fueled wildfires continue to ravage the West, we turn to look at how a well-known climate change denier has been tapped for a top position at NOAA. That's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. University of Delaware professor David LeGates has written papers calling for more fossil fuel emissions, has had his work supported by the Robert Mercer-funded Heartland Institute and Koch Industries, as well as major gas companies. In 2011, he was pushed out of his role as Delaware state climatologist for his views on climate change, which go against the scientific consensus. In 2018, the same year, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change warned humanity had only a dozen years to mitigate climate change or face global catastrophe. David LeGates spoke at a Heartland Institute conference on a panel called, quote, Why CO2 Emissions Are Not Creating a Climate Crisis.
We've all heard that carbon dioxide, of course, is a pollutant. It drives climate. It is the single most important factor that determines what the climate's going to be in the future and what the temperature is going to be and how much precipitation there's going to be, so much so that we have to put a danger sign on carbon dioxide. But the question I really want to ask is it really a benefit? Not just simply has it gotten a bad rap, but is it really something that we could do with a little bit more? So the answer to my question, is carbon dioxide a pollutant or a benefit? It clearly isn't a pollutant. It is definitely a benefit, and we can do with a little bit more of it.
David LaGates will serve as NOAA's Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Observation and Prediction. Top climate scientist Michael Mann told NPR he could not imagine, quote, a more misguided decision than the appointment. Well, for more, we're going to New Jersey, where we're joined by climate scientist who spent his career at NOAA, David Goodrich. He is the former director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Climate Observations Division. Since his retirement, he spent his time chronicling the effects of the climate crisis from his bicycle. He's the author of A Hole in the Wind, A Climate Scientist's Bicycle Journey Across the U.S., and most recently, just published, A Voyage Across an Ancient Ocean, in which he takes a bike journey from the Alberta tar sands in Canada to the Bakken oil fields of North Dakota. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Dr. David Goodrich. It's great to have you with us. We want to talk about your book in a minute and your journey, but start with David LaGates. What it means to have a top fossil fuel company funded scientist, as the head, one of the top people at NOAA, where you used to work.
Well, first of all, thanks very much for having me on, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here. I think the appointment of Dr. LaGates, you're basically, if you look at the science community, you have about 97% of the scientists disagreeing with the position of Dr. LaGates that carbon dioxide is a big problem and a big issue in climate. So it's is disappointing, to be sure. I know that the American Geophysical Union, which is sort of one of the biggest scientific organizations for geology and geophysics and oceanography in the U.S., has called for this appointment to be pulled back. So it's an issue. I'd also point out that it's certainly not the first time. I mean, once when I was working with NOAA back in 2002, there was White House interference where government reports documenting climate change were re-edited to say there's significant uncertainties in all of this. And it's actually been better than 30 years since James Hansen testified before Congress that we have detected a human signal in climate change. It's kind of time for the fog machine to stop, if you will.
I'm wondering if you can talk about the whole issue of climate catastrophe. Right now, we've got the hurricanes that are battering the Gulf Coast, and we've got this massive, unprecedented fires along the West Coast. And talk about how your latest book and your latest bicycle journey, as you followed what you call the ancient ocean, illustrates what's going on.
Well, what I tried to do on this bicycle trip, first time after I retired, I rode across the country from Delaware to Oregon, and looking at climate change along the way. And I thought maybe I could go ride to a place where climate change is coming from, where the carbon is coming from the ground. So I figured I would start in the tar sands of northern Alberta, which is one of the most carbon-intensive mining operations on the planet, and ride across the Alberta, Saskatchewan, North Dakota prairie to the Bakken oil fields of North Dakota, so I could see it sort of from two different sides of the border. And before I started from the town of Fort McMurray in Alberta, which is where the tar sands mining is centered, I chartered a plane, and you can really only see the extent of this from the air. It is, you're seeing, you know, from, say, 5,000 feet, which is where the plane was flying, you can see these what look like small pickup trucks, but they're actually the biggest dump trucks on the planet, going to and from the face of the tar sands mines. And then basically to take this oil is essentially boiled down with chemicals to where it can flow through pipelines. That takes an enormous amount of energy. Think about how much it takes to melt tar at 40 in a 40 below Alberta winter. So it takes a huge amount of energy just to get this this oil out of the ground. And then I rode through the northern boreal forest and across the plains to the Bakken fields of North Dakota, and that's a different landscape. I mean, I was riding in on a really hot day. It was pushing 95 degrees, and on the horizon, you're seeing oil flares, fires. It reminds you of Mordor out of Lord of the Rings. And there is a tremendous amount of fire going, flaring going on in the Bakken. So it's sort of two different sides of the same coin. In North Dakota, that's hydraulic fracturing or fracking going on rather than basically digging it out of the ground as you see in Alberta.
You write in your book, roughly 80% of currently known stocks of fossil fuels need to stay in the ground to keep climate change within somewhat manageable limits. Yet fossil fuel industries are still being incentivized to keep producing oil and have received massive bailouts during COVID, even as the oil industry is failing and prices are falling. Can you talk about this?
Sure. I mean, we've known for quite a while that burning fossil fuels is a major way that climate change is going on. And the idea that a large amount of the fossil fuel extraction is being supported by the government is amazing to me. What needs to happen is going to more renewable energy. In fact, policies have gone against support for wind and solar over the last couple of years. So it's something that is disappointing, but I liken the changing climate to sort of turning a ship, that there's a lot of momentum. Nobody's going to turn off fossil fuels tomorrow, but we need to start getting serious about it and stop subsidizing the production of fossil fuels both here and around the world.
You know, we spent time in North Dakota covering the indigenous struggles to protect the planet. And I was wondering if you can talk about how significant they were. You know, people, for example, leading the charge to oppose the Dakota Access Pipeline, which, of course, ultimately was built along with the Keystone XL that President Trump green-lighted in both cases.
Well, I think the protests actually have been very significant. I mean, Dakota Access was built. There is still legal action going on against the Dakota Access Pipeline, and Keystone has yet to be built. There is still legal action going on there. And I think what's happened is that the protests that came about from Standing Rock and from the environmental community at large have made building pipelines and moving fossil fuels around a far more difficult and expensive proposition. And I believe that's a good thing. You're basically trying to reduce the flow of carbon into the atmosphere. And pipelines are the way that happens. So there is still a lot of push to build pipeline capacity out of the tar sands in Alberta. And that is actually limiting how much activity is going on in the tar sands and in the Bakken as well.
And David Goodrich, we just have 30 seconds, but the link to what we're seeing on the West Coast, the unprecedented fires.
Sure. The warming has resulted in the drying out of the forests. basically setting them up to burn. There has been certainly issues with long-term forest management, but even in very well-managed forests, they have burned. And it's because it's gotten warmer, it's gotten drier, and it takes almost nothing to get the fires burning.
Well, David Goodrich, want to thank you for being with us, climate scientist, former director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. That's NOAA's Climate Observations Division. His new book, A Voyage Across an Ancient Ocean, A Bicycle Journey Through the Northern Dominion of Oil. We end today's show with the words of the late historian Howard Zinn. On Thursday, President Trump lashed out at educators who teach about the U.S. history of slavery and racism, announcing a so-called patriotic education plan to combat what he called toxic propaganda in schools. Trump called the teaching of critical race theory a form of child abuse, lashed out at the 1619 Project, the Pulitzer Prize-winning series by the New York Times, which reexamines the legacy of slavery. Trump also directly criticized Howard Zinn during his speech at the National Archives Museum in Washington, D.C.
Left-wing rioting and mayhem are the direct result of decades of left-wing indoctrination in our schools. It's gone on far too long. Our children are instructed from propaganda tracts like those of Howard Zinn that try to make students ashamed of their own history.
So we're turning back now to 2009, Howard Zinn appearing on Democracy Now! Less than a year before he died. He just published Young People's History of the United States. I asked him to respond to a question he'd frequently been asked about his work. Is it right to be so critical of the government's policies of the traditional heroes of the country?
It's true that people have asked that question again and again. Now, should we tell kids that Columbus, whom they have been told was a great hero, that Columbus mutilated Indians and kidnapped them and killed them in pursuit of gold? Should we tell people that Theodore Roosevelt, who is held up as one of our great presidents, was really a warmonger who loved military exploits and who congratulated an American general who committed a massacre in the Philippines? Should we tell young people that? And I think the answer is, we should be honest with young people. We should not deceive them. We should be honest about the history of our country. And we should be not only taking down the traditional heroes like Andrew Jackson, Theodore Roosevelt, but we should be giving young people an alternate set of heroes. Instead of Theodore Roosevelt, tell them about Mark Twain. Mark Twain, everybody learns about as the author of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. But when we go to school, we don't learn about Mark Twain as the vice president of the Anti-Imperialist League. We aren't told that Mark Twain denounced Theodore Roosevelt for approving this massacre of the Philippines. No, we want to give young people ideal figures like Helen Keller. And I remember learning about Helen Keller. Everybody learns about Helen Keller. You know, a disabled person who overcame her handicaps and became famous. But people don't learn in school, and young people don't learn in school what we want them to learn when we do books like A Young People's History of the United States, that Helen Keller was a socialist. She was a labor organizer. She refused to cross a picket line that was picketing a theater showing a play about her. And so there are these alternate heroes in American history. There's Fannie Lou Hamer and Bob Moses. They're the heroes of the civil rights movement. There are a lot of people who are obscure, who are not known. We have in this young people's history, we have a young hero who was sitting on the bus and in Montgomery, Alabama, refused to leave the front of the bus. And it was before Rosa Parks. I mean, Rosa Parks is justifiably famous for refusing to leave her seat, and she got arrested, and that was the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott and really the beginning of a great movement in the South. But we, this 15-year-old girl did it first. And so we are trying to bring a lot of these obscure people back into the forefront of our attention and inspire young people to say, this is the way to live.
That's Howard Zinn, appearing on Democracy Now! In 2009. Howard Zinn was attacked by President Trump on Thursday. The Zinn Education Project criticized Trump's call for patriotic education. The project tweeted, "So what explains the rebellions in 1676, 1680, 1786, and 1831, 1859, and more by Native Americans, enslaved Americans, enslaved Africans, coal miners, and more? Howard Zinn wasn't alive then," unquote. To see our full interview with Howard Zinn, you can go to democracynow.org, as well as all of our interviews with Howard Zinn over the years. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Adriana Contreras. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.